Welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. This is our first show of the new year, 2014, and our topic, I think, is a worthy one, social entrepreneurship. If you're like me, this may seem like a fuzzy concept. The word entrepreneur is often used to refer to a business person, yet the word social in front of it seems to modify the concept. But how? What exactly is a social entrepreneur? What part of the enterprise is business and what part is social? Why are we seeing them now? How important is profit? Where does the profit go? And how do you measure success? We'll find out today on Hometown Alaska. My guest is an expert on social entrepreneurism, Dr. Yasso Thiru, teaches in the undergraduate and MBA programs at Alaska Pacific University and has spent a couple of years exploring and documenting social entrepreneurs and enterprises in Alaska and abroad. Welcome, Dr. Thiru.
Thank you.
Also with me today is Julie Mettler, the gallery manager of Hope Studios, one of the social enterprise models happening right here in Alaska. Welcome, Julie.
Thanks for having me.
And I want to thank you both for taking time out of really busy schedules to join us today and share some information about social entrepreneurship, because I think there's a lot of curiosity out there. And actually, we've reached out to a couple of other people in Alaska that we know have social entrepreneurial interests. We may hear from them this afternoon. So in addition to talking about Hope Studios, we may talk about an enterprise out in Cordova. There's another one in Anchorage that the Cook Inlet Tribal Council has been responsible for. So we'll talk about a number of them. And we're very lucky to have Yasso here, who really can lead us through a lot of the discussions about it. I do want to invite people to join us in the conversation. If you're a social entrepreneur, we'd love to hear from you. Or if you're a consumer that wants more social enterprises, we'd love to hear from you. In Anchorage, you can call 550-8433. Or outside of Anchorage, it's 1-888-353-5752. And we do welcome your emails at hometown@alaskapublic.org. And I really want to refer you to our website, because if this show intrigues you, we have a lot of really interesting links, so go to alaskapublic.org and look for Hometown Alaska. We have some local links, some websites, and there's some things to read about social entrepreneurism if you really are learning about it for the first time. So let's get to our guests. Yasso, I want to welcome you. I know you have sort of a global perspective as well as an Alaska perspective. You're from Sri Lanka. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Thank you. What I'd like to share with you is, first, that I am a professor at Alaska Pacific University, and I've been teaching there for a number of years. My exposure to social entrepreneurship has been rather recent. I sort of stumbled into the area about 4 or 5 years ago, and I was very interested at the time in reading about corporate social responsibility and social justice, that kind of thing. So when I stumbled into this area, I just started reading up about it. And I started learning about social entrepreneurs and people who were making a huge difference in the most unlikely places in the world. Mm-hmm. For that reason, and I thought that I needed to get to know these people. What do they do? What kind of impact they are having in the world? So after I started reading about them, I started attending conferences, wanting to meet with social entrepreneurs. That one thing led to the other, and I have in the last two years, I've been writing and researching about social entrepreneurship.
I want to say something about, it's a kind of relatively new phenomena. When I was reading up on it, I found this one reference to entrepreneurs or business people. But in the social realm, people doing this kind of work were called humanitarians, you know, or revolutionaries or something like that. But we seem to see a blending of these two, which is interesting to me. So the idea that people do things not for profit isn't new, but there is something new about social entrepreneurism.
Correct. And for that very reason, there is no one universal definition for social entrepreneurship. So, because the people who are practicing social entrepreneurship come from all walks of life. There are people from all types of disciplines. So it's really difficult to come up with a definition. Mm-hmm. And what happens in academia and people who want to understand things, we like to label things. We like to define things.
Right.
So this has been a real difficult challenge for us. But one of the things that I'm finding out in my research is that typically social entrepreneurs have certain characteristics. I might mention three of the main ones. One is that they are really focused on solving problems. It's all about local social problem solving. Second thing is that they are really engaged with grassroots communities. So it's all about that focus.
On the ground.
The purpose on the ground is very important. And the third most important thing is to make that activity financially sustainable. So to a social entrepreneur, profit is important, right? But profit is a means to an end. As opposed to a commercial entrepreneur who is looking to create wealth or value, make profits as an end.
Right.
A social entrepreneur, that is a means to an end.
Right.
So that those are some of the distinguishing features of social entrepreneurs that we find out there.
You know, and well, go ahead. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
And also, depending on the part of the world where the social entrepreneurs are found, you will see a different take on how they see social entrepreneurship.
Right.
Itself. For example, now I'm familiar with some of the work that's happening in India, in Europe, and here in the States. So in India, though, a lot of work is going on in helping to get people out of poverty. A lot of poverty is in rural areas. So they're looking at rural development. And you know that in Bangladesh, a neighboring country of India, is where the microfinance concept
right.
was born.
Muhammad Yunus. Yes, right.
So there, the idea is that the people at the bottom of the pyramid don't have access to capital, right? So they are provided this capital through these microfinance organizations that help them to not only simply provide the capital, but also provide them education and empowerment and training and discipline to manage their finances.
Yeah.
So it essentially is a much larger than just providing money or access to capital.
Right. To me, it almost sounds as if human capital, there's human capital there that's not had opportunity or not had just the right nurturing, and that this might change the story. It might change the story of poverty if in fact, because these people, all people have potential. Everybody's got potential. You never know where the next great idea is going to come from. But if nobody ever has the chance to start, you know, so I get really excited about thinking, you know, how great the world might be if some of the people who haven't had the chance to contribute to it get the chance to contribute to it or resolve their own issues, resolve their own problems, as opposed to, you know, a model where people come in and solve problems for you, you know. I want to jump over to Julie. We just sort of got off and running, and I just want to welcome you to the show. Tell us a little bit about yourself. Are you from Alaska?
I wasn't born here, but basically I lived here for the majority of my life. Went to school out in rural Alaska, graduated from St. Mary's High School. I don't know if anybody remembers that boarding school.
In St. Mary's?
Uh-huh.
Oh, sure. I've definitely heard of it. Haven't been there.
Yeah. But I've worked for Hope Community Resources now for about the last 17 years in Anchorage.
And you are the gallery manager.
I am. And we have a artistic team that runs the studio, the work studio. And then the gallery is a place where some of that work is shown and then sold to the public.
Do you, and Hope, where is Hope Studios located?
Over on International Airport Road, 650 West International Airport Road.
And the artists that create the work are, who are they?
Most people that are working in the studio are people who are receiving supports from Hope Community Resources. And Hope Studios is part of Hope Community Resources.
Mm-hmm.
So most people are receiving supports of some kind. They have either developmental or intellectual disabilities. And we also encourage artists from the community who want to put work on commission in our gallery. We're hoping to become inclusive of all artists who are looking for a place to show their work. And that can lead to all kinds of interaction between the artists
sure.
we support and local artists in
sure.
the state.
Do you have First Fridays and things like
we
that?
We do. We've had a couple so far. We've only been open since June.
Mm-hmm.
We have a history of doing shows throughout town, but now in this space, we've had two First Fridays so far, and it's been really well received, I think, by the community.
Was there one just this past Friday?
Or no, December.
One? December. So when's the next one?
We're looking at doing one in, for sure, by May. And
okay.
maybe we'll peek one in there before then
yeah.
as well.
What I'd like to do is unpack Hope Studio as a social enterprise with Yasso's help and Julie's help. Let's talk about it. What makes it a social enterprise?
First of all, let me say that it is so much fun to go into the studio, to go to one of these First Friday events, to mingle with the artists who are there, and they talk to you, they help you with selecting items that we want to buy, whatnot. And it's a really beautiful piece of art that they do there, and they mostly work with wood and paints and colors, and it's very vibrant, authentic.
Yeah.
It's really wonderful. But it's, I think the satisfaction of you know, interacting with them comes from knowing that they're creating this really meaningful piece of art that they're sharing with the rest of us, and so that makes that satisfaction. You know
this idea of artists mingling with folks producing art and artists at the studio reminds me of this quote from a social entrepreneur, and I used it in the promo, but it's from kiva.org, and I'm just going to read it because it's short, mm-hmm. and it reminds me of this mingling, this bringing together. She says, "The stories we tell about each other matter very much. The stories we tell ourselves about our own lives matter. And most of all, the way we participate in each other's stories is of deep importance." So, I mean, I think that speaks to that satisfaction you're getting there, Yasso, when you mm-hmm. get to meet the artist, you see the pleasure that they have creating something.
And I think one of the greatest joys that we've seen was the friendships that people are building amongst themselves as well. People who might not have had an opportunity to express themselves in quite that way before, and certainly not to have their work valued in a community setting. It's exciting for any of us. Mm-hmm. And if you add to that that somebody might have had a little bit more limited opportunities, that's been something we didn't even plan for, I guess. And it's been great.
Yeah. And I mean, artistic expression can come from everywhere, right? You don't have to be a formally trained artist.
No.
Schooled with your art degree and all of that to actually have that ability to express yourself artistically. But let's talk about how is it social enterprise? Let's go specifically to that.
Okay, the social entrepreneurship piece comes from the financial sustainability part of it, and also working with grassroots level. So here we are looking at a group of people who are expressing themselves, telling their stories, and directly interacting with the society or the community in a financially sustainable way. The activities that they do need financial resources.
Mm-hmm.
And that comes from whatever it is that they're creating and sharing with the community. So that piece, the financial sustainability, makes the entrepreneurial, picks up that entrepreneurial aspect.
So how does it work? Are they contributing to your budget by selling the artwork? Or do they get some of the, how does it work?
So it's, I guess we're at the point of having baby steps right now with the program in general. But initially, the majority of people that are coming to the art studio are supported through Alaska's Medicaid waiver program. We're providing them habilitation support. So we're teaching them skills. Those skills could have to do with communication or motor skills, social skills, skills that have to do with learning to hold a job.
Mm-hmm.
Once they choose to have that sort of support in their plan, then they're offered opportunities from all kinds of providers throughout the state to teach those skills. They're coming to Hope Studios to learn those skills, and we're being reimbursed through Medicaid for that. What happens then is that they're learning those skills while doing art. Currently, the agency is really helping. You talked, Yasu, about needing the initial funding to get some of these things started. That's what Hope Community Resources is helping to provide on top of that. And the money that is gained by selling what artwork we do sell is going back into the studio to provide for materials and some of the facilities costs, some of the extra staffing costs, things like that. But what we're starting to see is that some of those artists are starting to branch out into a much more independent type of situation. We have a number of artists who are starting to consider or have already started their own businesses where they're taking the skills they've learned through Hope Studios and going and looking at how to set up some sort of production work and then selling that work back to us on commission. So we have a couple of people doing that right now and a few more who really are at the point where they could start to do that more fully.
Yeah, so you really see life-changing opportunity.
In a pretty short amount of time, really.
Yeah. If you've just joined us, I just want to ground you on what we're talking about, social entrepreneurism. I have two guests in the studio with me today. Yasuo Thiru is an Alaska Pacific University professor and a champion, I think I can say that, of social entrepreneurship. And Julie Mettler, who's the gallery manager of Hope Studios, which is an example of the beginnings of a social enterprise here in Anchorage. And, you know, I wanted to ask Yasuo whether you think, oh, I wanted to throw out the phone numbers too, I'm sorry. In Anchorage, it's 550-8433, or outside of Anchorage, and we may hear from somebody in Cordova today, so we'll see, 1-888-353-5752, or you can send us an email at hometown@alaskapublic.org. I wanted to explore a little bit about why we might be seeing this now. Sometimes I wonder if social entrepreneurism is a reaction to capitalism, like everything for profit. Is there another way? And I wonder, being on a university campus, Yasuo, do you sense that in young people? I'm just kind of open there on why you think we're seeing it. I heard reference that it's only really about 10 years old sometimes. You know, it's relatively new.
Yeah, it's a little bit older than that. And I think that there are two things that are happening out there right now. One is that the consumers are a bit more aware. They're demanding sustainable businesses, responsible business practices, and they're paying, you know, they are speaking with their money, and they're willing to patronize businesses that are transparent and they are socially, environmentally responsible. The investors are looking for impact investments. So I think it's picking up, it's coming to a point where I think we are beginning to see the tipping point where even the mainstream businesses are starting to talk about social responsibility in a way that is more sustainable and more authentic. What I see that is sometimes businesses do advertise that they are responsible towards the community and they are responsible towards the environment, but you don't know whether it's good marketing. Right? Or good business.
I wondered, so. Yeah. Because sometimes you've heard really awful stories about factories in other countries for clothing that is very popular in the United States, or even when they've claimed that they have a social responsibility approach to their, you know. So, I mean, what's a consumer to do? You know, I mean, would you advise, how can people do research to know whether it's really... What do you think about that?
Exactly. And I think that in the business school, we focus a lot on profit making, maximization of profit, and how do you reduce cost? How do you increase or maximize shareholder value? Well, that is the financial interest of the shareholders. But anymore, we have to start talking about how do we do all of that while also creating a material positive impact on the society and the environment. So we don't at the moment have the metrics that we would need to use in evaluating the impact.
Oh.
Right? And, you know, it's not enough just to look at earnings per share or dividends paid or return on investment, but we need to be looking at other metrics as well, the social impact metrics. And that's where the research comes in. So why we are becoming a little bit more aware of this, and why is this becoming a greater movement, is also because we are creating some corporate social forums that are conducive to doing social enterprise businesses. So in other words, the fiduciary responsibility of the board of directors are not simply to maximize the financial interests of the shareholders, but also to look after the non-financial interests of all the stakeholders. Mm. So 20 or so states in the union has created legislature to create something called a benefit corporation. That's in the works, and that's going to really happen quickly.
So that builds in that social responsibility into the success story of the corporation?
In other words, it requires the board of directors to be concerned with the environmental and social impact, and also demands greater accountability and transparency. So a company cannot say, we need to take this business out to the lowest labor market, we are going to make it in China or some other low-cost countries, just because that maximizes profit. But they also look at, what is the impact of that on the community where we are? Mm-hmm. So they are allowed that mm-hmm. Kind of decision making without any repercussions to run that corporation.
Yeah.
So that's the benefit of a benefit corporation.
Can you name any that you know are the new evolving models? Are they names that we would recognize?
Names of corporations.
Corporations that have adopted this benefit corporation model.
Ben and Jerry's. When Ben and Jerry's were created, this corporate form was not available. Somewhere in the early 2000s, Ben and Jerry's they claimed that they were forced to sell it to Unilever. So now Unilever owns it, this big corporation. But Ben and Jerry's, from the very beginning, their focus was on philanthropy.
That's true. All about philanthropy. And Paul Newman's another one, right?
Yeah.
He talks a lot about it being all profits go for, I forget what, but it's part of their marketing campaign on their jars of spaghetti sauce.
Exactly.
But, that's why I wonder, can we trust it? Or
exactly.
Yeah.
So with this legal form, then, it then becomes the board's responsibility to balance the two needs, the mm-hmm. non-financial and the financial interest of all stakeholders.
Wow. So. Well, it makes me think of the question of oversight, because we've certainly seen in Wall Street some problems with oversight and, derivatives or whatever those things were called. Would there be oversight for these benefit corporations, do you think?
There will be. SEC is going to play a role in that as well. And another example you had asked earlier about examples is Costco. Costco is a membership based organization.
Yes.
And they do not have any Wall Street pressures, but they are a example of a model.
I mean, it's been written up. They take care of their employees very well. They have health care. There's a lot of pluses, very social responsible approach, and it must work on the bottom line as well, right?
It does.
Yeah.
It does for them.
I know that I've read interviews by the founders of the company, and it's kind of like it's good business, I guess, if you're taking good care of your employees and,
The key is that some companies may do this because it's good for the image, mm-hmm. but the thing about that is, for consumers and interested potential investors, the question is, are they walking their talk? Are they really doing what they say they're doing? So that's where the regulation comes in, and once SEC starts taking part in creating some regulations that require them to report certain facts mm-hmm. About the work that they do, then mm-hmm. we can say, yes, we can trust this and this transparency.
Wow. So it's really an evolving model. And now, you mentioned to me when we were talking before the show that there's actually, if you're in a country that it has a socialist background versus, say, a capitalist, that it'll look different, social entrepreneurism or social enterprise will look different. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Okay, so in Western Europe, the focus on social entrepreneurship is around job creation. job creation and meeting the social needs of the people. So in a social economy, traditionally, the social, the welfare, all of that's the responsibility of the government. So they're looking, the government's now looking in this times, financially difficult times, when there is structural unemployment and there is budget deficits, they're looking for a way to create a sector, and then now they call it the third sector in Western Europe, that would take on this this responsibility of both creating new employment as well as meeting the social needs.
Mm-hmm.
So what they are focused on is creating these organizational forms. In UK, for example, there is an organizational forum called CICs, or Community Interest Corporations, which you might say sort of parallel to the benefit corporations that are being created here in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
In that, what they are saying is that by charter, these corporations should be focused on the community interest. So profit is one of the many interests of the communities.
Right.
So they have limitations on how much money can be distributed in dividends.
Mm-hmm.
That's one way of setting up the corporation.
And they actually tell them where some of their money has to go, maybe? It has to go into the community?
Into the community or back into the company.
Into the enterprise.
To grow, enterprise,
yeah,
to scale.
Yeah. One thought I had was whether social enterprises are actually doing a better job than our traditional nonprofit charities. I mean, is there some tension there between an old model and a new model? What do you think?
Not really. If you really look at the players in the social enterprise field here, let's talk about the U.S., is that many of them are nonprofits. Many of them are what we call enterprising nonprofits. Now I can say that Hope Studios might fall into that category as well. Traditionally, it is a nonprofit, but you're also looking at ways to sustain the activity,
mm-hmm,
right?
And that's
creating
the difference.
Impact,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Right. So, and also individuals who want to start a social enterprise have traditionally been sought out this nonprofit form. Because we don't have a legal form, separate legal form for social enterprises. So we also find businesses, small businesses, that are created for the purpose of meeting a social need, than doing that. So the players are both nonprofits as well as enterprises. And then what happens with the new forms that are being created, then it can make it even more accessible to players in that.
I'm going to take a little break here because we've got a guest coming on, and I just want to let our audience know what's happening. We're talking about social enterprise. I have two fabulous guests on with me today, Yaso Thiro from Alaska Pacific University and Julie Mettler, who's a gallery manager over at Hope Studios. And when we come back from the break, we're going to be joined by Dune Lankard, who is a social entrepreneur in Alaska, probably calling in from Cordova. So we'll take our little break right now. You're listening to Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
You're listening to Hometown Alaska from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 9 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Hometown Alaska on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm your host, Kathleen McCoy. Really excited about our show today, and we're starting to get some interaction with our audience. Our topic is social entrepreneurship and social enterprise, and what's the difference, and just the ins and outs of that to help us kind of unpack that. We've got Yasuo Thiro here from Alaska Pacific University, who's done recently a lot of work on research and connecting with social entrepreneurs and looking at the global picture, but also the Alaska picture. And also in the studio with us, we have Julie Mettler from Hope Studios. She's the gallery manager, and that's the beginnings of a social enterprise right here in Anchorage. But in addition, we have Duke Lankard on the phone. Hi, Duke. Dune, I'm sorry, Dune.
Yes, hello.
Hi, I'm so happy to hear from you.
Yeah, I'm sorry about the delay. I was busy doing some other things this morning, but I'm glad to join you and Yasuo and Julie.
We're really happy to have you, and I guess you're calling from Cordova?
I'm actually in Anchorage.
Oh, okay, you're from Cordova. I've read a little bit about you, and I reached out to you on Facebook hoping we would hear from you, and thank goodness we did. Why don't you just, I know you're an, I guess you would say an Ashoka Fellow. Is that the right way to pronounce that, Dune?
Yes. I'm an Ashoka Fellow and also a Prime Movers Fellow from Hunt Alternatives Fund and a Future Fish Cohort with a number of other fish entrepreneurs that are doing their part to help address seafood fraud and seafood fishery issues in all of our oceans around the world.
You know, I was reading online, just looking for social entrepreneurism in Alaska, and I came upon a blog post where a writer was mentioning the Regional Seafood Development Associations, RSDAs, as one potential social entrepreneurial effort. But why don't you tell us very specifically about your goals in Cordova? I think why don't you just tell us about it? I read a little bit, but I don't want to sort of, I'd like to hear it from you.
Okay, sure. It all started with the Exxon Valdez oil spill happening in our backyard. And in 1989, when that spill happened, basically the ocean died, and something inside of me came to life. And I realized that there was all these impacts that would happen to our community that, you know, someone was going to have to address. And when the prices of seafoods plummeted and our permits dropped down and in price, and there was bankruptcies and divorces and suicides and people losing their lifelong fishery businesses and tourism, everything. You know, we all thought that, you know, the cavalry would come in and we'd all become spillionaires. Well, that never happened. You know, we, Exxon appealed the settlement, the $5 billion settlement 17 times. We ended up only receiving about $500 million. Which is equivalent to one good day of fishing for the 20,000-30,000 plaintiffs that received a settlement. And so I felt that, you know, what was happening was the native corporations and different business leaders decided that they wanted to diversify the economy by starting to clear-cut all of the lands and developing roads and developing our remaining natural resources. And we just couldn't see that happen on our watch. And so me and my sister Pamela got some of our EAC people together, and we said, okay, you know, what can we do to, you know, try and address some of the changes that are happening? And we started working with Carol Hoover out of California, who knew a dear artist friend of ours, Janann Kirschmeyer. And we realized that if we became social change artists, you know, that we looked at creating nonprofits that could address some of the issues that we were facing in the region, that we really could make a difference. And so we got into conservation and ended up helping preserve 765,000 acres of trees that was scheduled to be clear-cut in the spill zone.
Wow.
And shortly after that, there was all this concern and interest in developing the Copper River Delta, which is one of the last thriving, richest wild salmon fisheries left on Earth. And so we said, well, you know, how can we you know, clear-cut the parallel path of the Exxon Valdez and still have a sustainable, thriving fishing industry. And so we decided to start several nonprofits, and Carol and I decided one afternoon we had to come up with a new model of doing business. And so we created this nonprofit plus for-profit equals social profit model, which means that we create these for-profit entities that generate revenues, like Yasso was saying, that is so critical to nonprofit work to create the social change that we want to see happen in our part of the world.
So
and that's when I started winning these awards.
I one of the things I read talked about something you that might open in 2014. Is that a cooperative, or what is that, Dune?
Yeah, it's a one of the nonprofit models is a community cold storage. So imagine a building that has several rooms, and one room is dedicated to any commercial fisherman who wants to value add and process and direct market his seafoods. Right now, only 1% of the fishermen in Alaska direct market their seafoods because they don't have a space to process and package and market their fish. Another room will be dedicated to subsistence users who, right now in rural Alaska, subsistence is critical to their existence. And so anybody who wants to process value add their subsistence source of food will not only double the quality, but they can double the quantities and take care of their families. And that's money in the bank. Another room will be dedicated to anyone who wants to do research and development on final finished products and recipes, therefore creating cottage industry in their communities. And so the idea is that the facility would run off of solar, wind, tidal, biodiesel, and hydro. So it would be a community service, but it would be a for-profit incubator for local cottage industry.
You know, Dune, I want to invite Yasso in to talk a little bit, unpack that a little bit as a social enterprise. I hear a lot of it in there, the grassroots, the, making some profit. But just address it a little bit. Have you been working with Dune? I don't know that.
Yes, I really reached out to Dune when I was learning about social entrepreneurs, and I found out that Dune is Ashoka fella. So I reached out to him, and I, in fact, visited Cordova, spent some time with them, and learned about the work that they're doing. But Dune, I think that one of the things that we could hear from you is about the co-op model that you were talking about in creating for the fishermen's businesses that you're looking at. I believe that is part of your 2014 initiative.
Sure. And it's more of a collective than it is a cooperative. Fishermen historically don't like the word cooperatives, and they had bad experiences with them in the Cordova in the Copper River fishery, and then all the drama that, you know, took place in the Supreme Court over the Chignik cooperative.
Oh.
So people are a little bit, you know, leery, but what we're, doing is we're working with fishermen in a collective who want to figure out how to process and value add their seafoods and be able to sell them direct. And one of the things is that what a lot of people don't realize is that out of the 50 to 70 billion pounds of seafoods harvested annually around the world, about 45% of that ends up being waste because of how that seafood product was handled within the first hour of harvest. And so what we want to do is work with the fishermen to focus on that first hour of harvest. And in some cases, if they're able to pressure bleed the fish at sea, use nanowise that melts at 100 degrees rather than the temperature of the fish, look at different types of freezing and handling techniques that would increase the quality. By being able to sell the direct to the consumer would pay less money for a higher quality product. And then, you know, there's also, you know, the issue of seafood fraud. And so traceability becomes very important. And so, you know, right now there's much more Copper River salmon sold than actually harvested. And so what that means is that, you know, other people, other brokers, processors are selling their catches Copper River. And so when you look at the industry and the way that, you know, people are thinking, like Yasso mentioned early on, that people are more conscious and aware, consumers, of where their product is coming from. Is it sustainable? Does it make sense? You know, like imagine a 50-pound wetlock box, and a wetlock is what they sell seafoods in. And you look at the wetlock and you can see that it's biodegradable or recyclable. So that's it. You the consumer gets what they ordered, and so that box doesn't end up being in a landfill that lasts a long, long time.
You know, Dune, I just want to break in here, just because you mentioned consumer, and I remember a story out of New York where they were actually checking to see if it really was the kind of fish that the restaurant was saying was on the plate, and there was some enormous amount that was not what it was advertised to be. So this idea of transparency, you know, able to trace it, it's really, and you're here at the grassroots level trying to make sure that's happening. But there you have, like in a big city like New York City, where consumers are kind of getting burned, paying top dollar and not even eating the fish they think they're, you know. So, I mean, I just wanted to throw that in there as an example.
It's like, it's upwards of like 70%, you know, fraud. That you're not receiving what is being it's being marked down as.
Yeah.
And so like our product, like let's say you pull out a fillet, and you look on the fillet, and there's a code where you plug in the website, you plug in the number on the fillet, you can find out when the fish was caught, where it was caught, who caught it, how they caught it. You can email that fisherman directly and thank him, and place a new order, as well as know that a percentage of the profits is going to protect the habitat from where that salmon came from. That's going to really, you know, open up the relationship between the consumers and the buyers of wild salmon.
Yeah.
And so what we want to do is, you know, not only continue saving habitat and continue our conservation work, but really look at different models of doing business to guarantee that what the consumer is buying, they're actually getting.
You know, Dune, I could talk to you all day about this. It's great because it's such Alaska fish are just, I mean, I'm suddenly very grateful for the fish that I'm getting here. And I really know it's sockeye. But we do have other callers coming in and I have to move on. But I wanted to give Yasso a chance to make a last comment about all the information Dune's shared with us.
One thing I'd like to add from a problem solving perspective at the danger of oversimplifying this is that, as you see, the center of this is the providing the individual fishermen access to market, directly access to the market, right? So you remove, when you have a long supply chain, then the problem of at the end products wondering whether this really is the product that I'm paying for. But now here, not only are you resolving that issue, but you're also allowing the fishermen to have direct access to market through these collectives.
Right.
And then Dune was talking about the processing methods of how you handle the fish and how you process them. And so there is authenticity, there is transparency, there is a shorter supply chain. Everybody wins in this.
Yeah.
And so that is actually changing the way we do business.
Yes.
And I don't think it's only with fish. I think that whole concept of collective can lend itself to art or to other business models as well. I know that Alaska, the University of Alaska through the Center for Human Development, and I think it's the NEA, we're having a forum this May of artists with disabilities who are looking to get into careers in the arts. And so it's agencies like HOPE and FOCUS and all over the state who are going to meet.
Yeah.
And I think some collectives might come out of that forum as well.
You know, I had an interesting, just the whole discussion of this long supply chain and the fish in New York, is it really, really what they say it is on the menu? I had an interesting conversation with, he's a professor, but at any rate, I said, how did our food system get to be this giant industrial complex where we feel so removed? And he said it really was from World War II, where there were many hungry people in World War II, and the idea that we could industrialize food sounded like a really good idea. We could, you know, but it kind of got away from us in a way. And so there's this great drive to get back to, so you know your fisherman or you know your farmer or whatever, you know, and you really know what you're getting. So, but We actually have Tim Blum calling in from Cook Inlet Tribal Council. And Tim is another person I reached out to because speaking with Yasu, I know that they had some social enterprise efforts underway. Welcome, Tim.
Yes, thank you, Kathleen. Good to be here. Thanks for having us.
Yes, and so why don't you go ahead and tell us about Shanlut. I'm getting better at pronouncing that. Tell us a little bit about that because that is really kind of the crux of your initiative.
Great. Thanks, Kathleen, and hello to everyone there at the panel. And forgive me if we cover things that I've missed as I'm just joining the conversation. Our Shanlut Recovery and Reentry Program is a fairly unique model in town. There are some other programs that operate similarly, but what it is, it's a two-year residential work training and education program for some of the men in the community who are challenged and looking to reenter the society after either challenges with addiction or homelessness or incarceration. So Shanlut steps in and provides a buffer, offers residential room, board, and clothing, life skills training and mentoring, and counseling and group sessions. It's a residential program that operates and runs like a family.
So what businesses
mentoring, I'm sorry, go ahead.
What business might we take advantage of knowing that the benefit goes to Shanlut? I mean, are there businesses in town that we could know about?
They sure do. As part of that, as part of the Shanlut program, life skills and work training is a fundamental part of the process. You come and you first migrate into the population in the residence. First thing you do is you get out and you start working. We teach you work ethic. We provide work training and opportunities to do so. Now, some of those opportunities we have here in Anchorage are a variety: food service, janitorial services, wholesale food supply, lawn maintenance, light snow removal. We had the Mountain View Diner for some time in Mountain View, which was a great project. That closed last year just due to some program needs, because the programming aspect of Shanlut comes first. And sometimes, as we know, with restaurants, it can be very challenging to maintain.
Right. They have one of the toughest survival statistics.
Yeah, it really is. And while it was a great project, provided some great opportunities for both our participants and the community, some needs of the program shifted, and that had to come first. So we reviewed our social enterprise opportunities, want to maximize the training opportunities for the participants as well as the available community, the service to the community that we could offer.
So Tim, I have a link to on the alaskapublic.org to the Shanlut page, and I guess I just want people to know that these businesses are here and they can patronize them and read about them. I mean, in a sense, we vote with our dollars, and so if we
absolutely right,
yeah,
we have lots. Yeah, and you know, the best thing about this is when someone in the community utilizes a CITC business, whether it be the Coho Cup Cafe in our Natu Service Center, a full-style coffee shop that operates not only here at CITC but also at the Primary Care Center at the Alaska Native Medical Center campus and seasonally at the Alaska Native Heritage Center. It's a full-service coffee shop that provides espresso and coffee drinks and other lighter fare menu options. We also have Shanlut Janitorial Services. They come and do businesses in the evenings during closed hours. They service our building here at Cook Inlet Tribal Council, and we have several other partners in the community whom they come in and they work at night. We have janitorial services and wholesale foods as well.
Did you tell me that Providence Hospital was a big consumer am I wrong about that?
No, I don't believe so.
I
believe the Claudies.
Our partners, yes. Shanlut Wholesale Foods provides food items for resale for a variety of people in the community.
I just think about how big Providence is.
Salads, things like that. Yeah. I believe Providence, Alaska, is one of our largest clients of Shanlut Wholesale Foods. Yeah.
Yeah. So okay.
So in terms of the social impact, you're really getting a double bottom line. You're not only getting a good quality and service at a competitive rate, but you're also knowing that you're giving a chance and you're helping to improve the lives and help some of these programs and services where these people are really trying to find self-sufficiency and migrate back in the community and be proactive in that effort. So.
Well, that's great, Tim. Yasu, do you have anything to add to what Tim's kind of, or Julie, anything?
No, I'm excited to look online and see what they offer, though. Yeah. I didn't know they were there, so that's great.
Yeah, this is news for people, news you can use. Yeah,
yeah, Tim,
right.
Tim, thank you for...
Just go by our website at citci.org, and we have an entire area on CITC businesses there where you can be involved. We also have extra information on our Shanlut program and to learn more and becoming involved with that as well. We have in-kind needs for that program. We have financial needs. But, of course, the easiest and most convenient for way to anybody in the community to support that cause is to utilize one of the CITC Sean Luke-driven businesses.
Yeah, and I'm just going to invite Yasu just to make a comment because she's sort of our residential expert here about obviously there's a social benefit. Are we at the for-profit area yet here? Probably not, right?
Not all social enterprises are fully sustaining, profitable entities. Right?
Yeah.
There's some of that, they have to depend on donations. Mm-hmm. They are also in the form of nonprofits, so that's part of that. What's unique about this operation is that this is different. Is actually modeled after a very successful social enterprise from San Francisco, is called Delancey Street Project. If anybody wants to look them up, they can do that. And it's like Tim explained, the restaurant, the diner part didn't kind of work out for them for program reasons and programmatic reasons, but this is sort of the purpose is what you are looking at. So what is the purpose of this particular enterprise? It is about getting men back into the society as productive citizens, doing it in a way that builds job skills
right.
for them.
Right.
Right?
Success, chance for success. Yeah.
Exactly. So that is the purpose. Entrepreneurial activity supports that. This is very typical. We see a lot of social enterprises both operate as what we like to call enterprising nonprofits. So they
enterprising nonprofits,
nonprofits, but they also have the enterprising arm that supports them at this time when there are funding cuts and budget cuts and stuff.
So I'm going to say thank you, Tim, because we've got another caller and we'd love to get as many examples of this on the air as we can today. So thank you so much. And I do invite people to go to alaskapublic.org and find the Sean Mute link, or to go to CITC.org and find it there. And thanks so much, Tim. And I'm going to shift over to Antonio. Welcome to Hometown Alaska, Antonio.
Good. Thank you. I'm calling from Alaska Community Action on Toxics. A couple of years ago, we had the idea to participate and create the social entrepreneur doing janitorial services. Our mission and our organization is advocacy about environmental health. Our mission is by advocacy for environmental community health. We believe everyone have a right to clean air, clean water, toxic-free food, and then... regarding that, we start to create a mission-related business, help community or teach community to cleaning houses, cleaning building without toxics, and also give opportunity to other organizations and support them, bring people and teach skill to all of them. We working really, really close with Catholic Social Services. We bring our hand labor from the refugee program. We teach people who become as a refugee in the United States how to clean, how to use cleaning product. And the main things, or our main goal is done to create our enterprise. We use a lot of sources in the communities. That's is my point right now. We use free services from other organizations. We use free services from other university. University of Maryland give it to us the business plan. University of Washington.
Oh, I see. In terms of guidance or a path to follow?
Yes, yes. Is it good to use free services from or free knowledge from other organization or other communities? That is really helpful if you are able or if you want to put your organization in good fit.
You know, Antonio, we got an email from maybe one of your colleagues there at Alaska Community Action on Toxics. Holly writes to us that she's writing a little bit about this green cleaning service. using non-toxic products and methods. So I guess that speaks to your mission of getting away from toxics, but you've added to your mission this notion of, I guess, helping new arrivals in Anchorage to find work through your janitorial work, right?
Yes. And, we're working with the refugee program. That's the first program. We don't put away other programs. We want to incorporate many other social programs who need to create a skill or create opportunity to job
for jobs. Yeah.
Another.
But there's also an educational aspect here where people are actually learning about how to clean their homes, you know, with products that don't harm them.
Exactly. I think that is what makes it unique in that it has the model it uses, it creates employment for people that needs employment. At the same time, it has a unique model that it offers a unique product, mm-hmm. which is a safer product to use. And then also the education piece, that we as consumers need to know about how damaging these toxic cleaners can be to our health. So it's kind of a really well-rounded.
I'm interested in how consumers can learn about these. Do you have a website, Antonio, where people can read about green products, or how do you get the word out about the non-toxic cleaning products?
Well, the first way then you can learn a little bit about our program is a link in our website. Is Alaska Community Action on Toxic. You can Google that. Inside that, you can reach our program, the Green Cleaning Program. The other way then we outreach is by flyers, using free media and by word, by our client, whoever received the service.
Sure, word of mouth.
The word of mouth to other ones. And we become really, really successful, especially now we have a lot of pregnant women or family who have children who are really concerned about the health or the environment.
That's right. I understand. And I'm actually going to, we're just down to the last minute or so, Antonio. So I want to say thank you so much for calling in and sharing. And I think what we want to do with our last minute here is probably leave our audience something to think about. So thank you, Antonio. And I'm going to turn back to Yasso and Julie. And how do we want people to leave the program? What do we want to be top of mind as we kind of wind down here?
I'd just like to say that listening to Yasu and everybody else who called in, it really is important to see how many different aspects of somebody's life social entrepreneurship touches. So it's quality of life, it's job skill, it's making a better environment for you. It's not just one angle. And I think all of the people who talked on the phone had something to share about that.
Yeah.
So I appreciate that, and thanks for the opportunity.
And how about you, Yasu?
You had earlier asked about potential pressures between. So I'm thinking about, some people call it conscious capitalism. And so I think that what I would like people to leave with is the idea that it is really important to be aware and to ask good questions. And there are lots of resources out there if you wanted to know more about it. And if you, whether you have it in you to become a social entrepreneur, that'll be great. If I may put a plug in here for a project that's coming up, which is I am collecting stories of social entrepreneurs of Alaska to put a documentary together. So
All
if
right.
you know any social entrepreneurs, you are a social entrepreneur, contact us.
All right.
So and that would be something that I'd like to
all
add.
All right.
Yes.
That's wonderful. I'm sorry we didn't get to talk about that earlier. But I really want to thank Yasso Thiro and Julie Mettler for being our guests on social entrepreneurism as a topic for Hometown Alaska. Next week, Charles Walforth will be here talking about the pros and cons of moving the People Mover to Midtown instead of downtown. And Hometown Alaska is on the web at alaskapublic.org. You can join us on Facebook at Alaska Public. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Alaska Public Media. Kristen Platt is our web editor and audio engineer. Thank you so much for joining us today on Hometown Alaska. I'm Kathleen McCoy.
Home Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.